Welcome to the Ben Tibbetts Podcast. This is episode 1, and it was recorded on November 17th, 2017. So, I'm experimenting with this podcast as a format in which I can discuss topics that are interesting to me. Things that either I feel that I know a little bit about, or would like to learn more about, or questions that I have that I feel that are hard to answer and interesting to think about. My background is in piano performance and music composition. What I'm doing right now is I'm working as a freelance musician in Western Massachusetts. I play at UMass Amherst and at Hampshire College and Orchard Covenant Church and a few other places in the area, as an accompanist mostly. And I compose for people who need music and need original audio. So I'm a little bit all over the place in terms of my work. There are a lot of different hats that I wear over the course of a day. And actually, one of the hats, in addition to all that, is being a teacher. I do have a couple of piano students, and I really enjoy teaching them. And I thought maybe it would be useful to experiment with this podcast as a format in which I could take some of the things that I talk about in lessons and things I think about during the day, and just broadcast it to whoever might find it useful and interesting. So that's what I'm trying to do here. Today, for episode 1, I'd like to start with a topic that might seem like it's almost too basic or too elementary, but I don't think it actually is. It's sound. I'd like to talk about sound. So it can actually be a hard question to answer what music is. And different people have different answers to that question. I'm not entirely sure what my answer is, but I think it's kind of fluid. For me, music is kind of an experience I have. Almost all the music I listen to is either coming to me as it's basically coming to me in one of three forms. It's either a performance, like a live performance, an audio recording, something that I'm listening to through speakers or through headphones, or it's a participation experience where I'm making music with somebody else. And all three of those are pretty distinct experiences. I kind of wish I had different words for each of those things. So music as an experience does change for me depending on the context and on the framing. But I think one thing everybody can agree on is that music has something to do with sound. Music involves sound. And one thing that's interesting about that is that many musicians, I feel, go for long stretches without really thinking or learning about what sound actually is. Even though they're dealing with sound experiences all day long. And to be honest, I'm one of these people to a certain extent. When I'm at UMass making music, I'm not really thinking about how the strings of the piano are vibrating to create the sound that I'm making out of the instrument. It's not very useful to think about what you're doing in a way that's that granular. I think you have to back away from the details of what sound is most of the time to make music. But I think it's very useful to occasionally learn more about sound and about, I guess in general, the elementary basic topic surrounding what you're doing, right? The first principles. So today I'd like to read an article by Tim Urban. Tim Urban is a blogger. He is the mastermind behind one of my absolute favorite blogs. This is Wait But Why. And if you're interested in checking this out or reading along with me, it's waitbutwhy.com. And Wait But Why is fabulous. It's this collection of blog posts that are, they tend to be very long posts, like thousands of words, like 50 to 90,000 words, which try to drill down on first principles. And Tim is just a very good writer, a very clear writer. His illustrations in the articles are excellent and often very funny. And these articles are eminently readable. In fact, I would be comfortable giving many of them to children. And Tim has produced versions of many of these blog posts that are kind of scrubbed clean of any profanity or adult topics. So this is a very easy blog to read, and I would just highly recommend it for anybody who's interested in learning more about the topics he writes about. And he tends to write about philosophically interesting topics, scientifically interesting topics. He did a series on Elon Musk's several companies, which was fabulous. And he's done blog posts on energy and on artificial intelligence, and some silly, fun ones on silly pictures of animals and things like that. The article I'd like to read from Wait But Why is Everything You Should Know About Sound. And this was published on March 9th, 2016. Instead of reading the article directly, I'm going to be reading my way through it with some edits, sort of on the fly. These edits are basically to find a way of turning this article into a podcast-friendly form, because there are some illustrations in this article, and the illustrations are good, so I'd recommend checking it out. But if you don't read it, you can get it from me right now. I'm just going to leave out some of the text and edit the text very slightly so as to help the article make sense without the illustrations. So here we go. Everything You Should Know About Sound by Tim Urban. I've always been a little confused about sound. We think of sound as something we hear, something that makes noise. But in pure physics terms, sound is just a vibration going through matter. The way a vibration goes through matter is in the form of a sound wave. Now, when you think of a sound wave, you probably think of something that looks like a snake. A wave like that is called a transverse wave. In a wave like that, each individual particle moves up and down. But that's not how sound waves work. A sound wave actually looks more like an earthworm. Sound moves by compressing and decompressing, which is called a longitudinal wave. So if you imagine a slinky, you can actually create both of these waves on a slinky. If you hold the slinky outstretched and you wiggle it up and down, that creates a transverse wave. And if you hold the slinky between your hands and compress it and decompress it together, as if you're clapping, that's a longitudinal wave. Sound starts with a vibration of some kind that creates a longitudinal wave through matter. And instead of a curvy snake wave, sound is a pressure wave, which causes each piece of the air to be at either higher than normal pressure or lower than normal pressure. And that could be air or any other material that sound is traveling through. So when you see a snake-like illustration of a sound wave, it's actually referring to the measure of pressure, not the literal path of movement of the particles. Sound waves can go through air, which is how we normally experience it, but it can also go through liquid or solid matter. Actually, much of the jolting that happens during an earthquake is the result of a huge sound wave whizzing through the earth. How about the speed of sound? Well, the speed of sound depends on how quickly the pressure wave can move in any given medium. So a medium that's more fluid, like air, is highly compressible, so it takes longer for the wave to move, while water is far less compressible, so there's less give to slow the wave down. It's like two people holding an outstretched slinky between them. If one pushes their end towards the other person, the wave will take a little time to travel down the slinky before the other person feels it. But if the other two people are holding a broomstick, when one pushes, the other feels it immediately, because the broomstick is much less compressible. So it makes sense that the speed of sound in air is about 4 times slower than the speed of sound in water, which itself is about 4 times slower than the speed of sound through a solid, like iron. And the speed of sound in air is actually 768 miles per hour, or 1,234 kilometers per hour. Ears are an evolutionary innovation that allow us to register sound waves in the air around us and process them as information. Without ears, most sound waves are imperceptible to a human, with only the loudest sounds registering as a felt vibration on our skin. Ears give us an ability to sense even slight sound waves in a way so nuanced it can usually tell us exactly where the sound is coming from and what the meaning of it is. And it enables us to talk. The most important kind of human communication happens when our brains send information to other brains through complex patterns of air pressure waves. And this part is adorable. Tim says, have you ever stopped and thought about how incredible that is? He writes, I was about to move on, but sorry, I can't get over this. The next time you're talking to someone, I want you to stop and think about what's happening. Your brain has a thought. It translates that thought into a pattern of pressure waves. Then your lungs send air out of your body. But as you do that, you vibrate your vocal cords in just the right way, and you move your mouth and tongue into just the right shapes that by the time the air leaves you, it's embedded with a pattern of high and low pressure areas. The code in that air then spreads out to all the air in the vicinity, a little bit of which ends up in your friend's ear, where it passes by their eardrum. When it does, it vibrates their eardrum in such a way as to pass on not only the code, but exactly where in the room it came from, and the particular tone of voice it came with. The eardrum's vibrations are transmitted through 3 tiny bones and into a little sac of fluid, which then transmits the information into electrical impulses and sends them up the auditory nerve and into the brain, where the information is decoded. And all of that happens in an eighth of a second, without any effort from either of you. Talking is a miracle. And then he kind of gets back on track and he goes, anyway, he starts talking more about the science. So, anyway, the ear can discern many qualities of a sound it hears, but two of the most fundamental are pitch and loudness. And then we start a new section on pitch. Pitch is all about wavelength. In other words, how far apart the pressure waves are. The shorter the wavelength, the higher the pitch. Humans can hear frequencies as low as 20 hertz, which is a wave that's 56 feet long. And we can hear as high as 20,000 hertz, which is a wave that's only about 7/10 of an inch long. As you age, you lose your ability to hear the highest pitches. So most of you will probably hear nothing when you listen to the frequencies approaching 20,000 hertz. But you'll have an easier time hearing the lowest part of the range. The reason you can feel low sounds, like low bass notes in music, is that the wavelength is so long that it actually takes a 20th of a second for a full wave to pass through your body. And that's where the 20 hertz measurement comes from. Then there's a section on loudness. So the loudness of a sound we hear is determined by the amplitude of the pressure waves. So louder sounds have a larger oscillation between the low and high pressure sections of the wave. So loud sounds have higher high pressure and lower low pressure parts than quiet sounds do. So in other words, if you imagine the snake, right? The shorter the distance of the waves are, that's how high the pitch is. So if it's a slinky that's really compressed, that's a really high pitch, versus really stretched out, that's a really low pitch. And the loudness is determined by how high and low those pressure waves go. So how, I guess how wide the slinky would be, right? So it could either be like a long, thin slinky, and that's like a soft sound, or it could be a fat slinky, and that's a really loud sound. For sounds through the air on Earth's surface, the average of the high pressure and low pressure parts of the wave is our normal atmospheric pressure, what we call one atmosphere of pressure. So a sound wave might have a high pressure component of slightly more than one atmospheres and a low pressure component of slightly less than one atmospheres. And a louder sound might be 1.01 versus 1.0001 for the high pressure and 0.99 instead of 0.999999. But in both cases, the average of the two is one atmosphere. So again, just because that's a little bit dense, sound is the vibration of the air, right? And the average of the high pressure and low pressure parts of the wave is just our normal atmospheric pressure. And that's true even if the highs are really high and the lows are really low or not. We often measure loudness using a unit called the decibel. And then Tim says, if you want to be confused, read the Wikipedia page on decibels. It's a super icky unit. And rather than bore us both by explaining it, let's just talk about how we use decibels to measure sound. So I guess we're not getting into decibels today. So the scale of loudness has a very tiny minimum. The faintest sounds are far softer than any human could hear, even softer than any of our finest scientific instruments could detect. But depending on where you are, sound has a hard maximum. The reason is that sound isn't a thing in itself, it's a pressure wave moving through a medium. And since the average of the high and low pressure points of a sound wave has to be the normal pressure of the medium, loudness is limited by the fact that eventually the low pressure point hits zero pressure, which is a vacuum. Since the low pressure can't go any lower, that point determines the max amplitude of a sound wave, and the loudest a sound can be in any given place. So just to rephrase that, when a sound is so loud that the low pressure points on the wave cause the air to go to zero atmospheres, that's the loudest a sound can actually be in that atmosphere. It can't get any louder because of the hard, sort of the hard boundary of the vacuum. Nature doesn't like a vacuum. So the convenient thing about decibels is that the absolute faintest sound detectable to the human ear is by definition zero decibels. We call that the threshold of hearing. Scientists do their best to study sounds far down into the negative decibel scale, and there are man-made rooms on Earth that register as low as negative 9.4 decibels, where it's so quiet you can hear the blood pumping through your own brain. But we can only hear sounds in the decibel positives. The loudest a sustained sound can possibly be on Earth's surface is 194 decibels, which is when the amplitude of the sound wave is so intense that the low pressure part is a perfect vacuum. In other words, the wave alternates between double the normal atmospheric pressure and no air at all, which, as Tim writes, is not something you want to be present for. And then he has this sound scale, which starts with the really quiet and moves up to the really loud. And I'd like to describe that for you. And as I describe this, one thing to keep in mind is that with decibels, each increase of 10 decibels doubles the loudness. So 20 decibels is twice as loud as 10 decibels. 30 decibels is 4 times as loud as 10 decibels. And 80 decibels is 128 times louder than 10 decibels. And so on. So the sound scale goes like this. Between 0 and 10 decibels, you have the threshold of hearing, where if the sound's any softer, you can't hear it. And something like the sound of a flying mosquito from 10 feet away. At about 10 decibels, we get to the faintest sounds we can hear, really. And some sounds like an incandescent light bulb humming, or a pin dropped from 1 centimeter up, heard from one meter. So that was a little awkward. So a pin dropped from 1 centimeter above, like a floor, heard from 1 meter away, is what I meant. And then when you get to 20 decibels, that's like leaves rustling. And when you get to 30 decibels, that's like somebody whispering from a few feet away. From 40 to 50, you have like a quiet office. And somewhere around 60 decibels, we get to the level of normal conversation. And when you start getting past 60 decibels, things start to get annoying. So between like 60 and 85 or so, you have a vacuum cleaner at 70 decibels, a garbage disposal at 80 decibels. And around 85 decibels, you start to have to worry about long-term exposure leading to damage to your ears. And here we start to get to kind of loud sounds, uncomfortably loud sounds. So at 90 decibels, you have a lawnmower and a food blender. At about 100 decibels, you have a motorcycle, a jackhammer, and a stereo, like a normal stereo, at maximum volume. At 110 decibels, you have a car horn. And at around 115 decibels, the human body begins to perceive vibration in low frequencies. So right about at 120, you have a loud rock concert. And I love this one that Tim includes. He mentions that around 120 is a blue whale yelling. And that's really cool. It's actually, apparently it's actually 186 decibels for that one, but it's about 123 decibels equivalent in water. And right around this point in the decibel scale, pain begins, and tinnitus, which is ringing in the ears, starts to be a problem. So right around 120 to 130 is the loudest human scream as heard from 3 meters away. At 130 decibels, there's the sound of a jet engine at about 30 meters. And at this point, you can start to noticeably feel your eardrum flexing. And at 136 decibels, there's the loudest band performance. So 136 decibels was Kiss in 2009. And you start to feel strong vibration in the body. And here things get pretty intense. At 140 decibels is the sound of a gunshot. And around this point, this is when even short exposure can cause permanent ear damage. And around this point, the human nose can start to itch and vision becomes blurry. Somewhere around 150, there's the Formula One race car at 700 horsepower. Between 150 and 160, it gets to be hard to swallow, and you start to get the sensation of being underwater, and the vibrations begin to affect your organs. So around 160 would be inside the speaker at a rock concert. And here we get to the pretty intense stuff. From 160 to 170, permanent hearing loss is likely. And at 170 decibels, you're at the level of the Saturn V launch from 100 meters away. At 180, that's 1 pound of TNT from 5 meters away. At this point, you're looking at probable death. Around 190 is the epicenter of a grenade. And at 194 is the threshold of sound. That's about as loud as, that's as loud as sound can go on Earth. So, pretty cool. Cool to read about. Not, probably not cool to experience a lot of those later things. So as he writes, the scale stops at 194 because there's no such thing as a louder sound on Earth's surface, but we can go beyond here in two ways. So the first way of going past 194 decibels is through shockwaves. And he has a section on shockwaves. When enough energy is released to pass the 194 decibel mark, it's too much to create a sustained pressure wave because we've bottomed out on low pressure. But things still happen. And as he writes, very, very intense things. At 194 decibels, there's a maxed out wave alternating between double the normal pressure and a total vacuum. But once we get to 195 decibels, the energy stops moving through the air and starts pushing the air outward with an expanding vacuum. The more decibels above 194 there are, the farther reaching and higher impact that vacuum bubble will be. And this expands outward as a rapidly growing half sphere. So you have to imagine like a bomb going off and this sphere of air expanding outward from the blast radius. And he's got some illustrations on the blog, which I would recommend. It's kind of a beautiful thing. Again, a beautiful thing to see, not a beautiful thing to experience. On the edge of the bubble is a barrier of supercompressed gas. And when this barrier sweeps out over the land, it usually flattens whatever's in its path. As the hemisphere expands, it loses energy and eventually dissipates. But if you found yourself in the path of a shockwave before that happened, Tim writes, you'd have a bad time. First, the impact of the supercompressed barrier would be like hitting a brick wall in the same way and for the same reason that falling on water from a bridge is like falling on concrete. Second, compressed air is hot. Third, it wouldn't just hit all parts of your body, it would go through your body. And if it were powerful enough, it could turn your bones to powder and your organs to soup. And he has a list of some famous events through history that were louder than 194 decibels, or more powerful, I should say, than 194 decibels. The first one he lists is the Saturn V launch. The Saturn V was a beast. And the sound waves from its launches were so intense that they could light grass on fire a mile away. Even at 3 miles away, an observer would experience ear-splitting 135 decibel sound. Rocket launches create such a powerful sound that space agencies flood the launch pad with water as the rocket launches to absorb the sound, so the force of the pressure wave doesn't damage the rocket. The Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs clocked in at over 200 decibels. The shockwave was so charged that it traveled 7 miles in 30 seconds, which is pretty amazing. The 1883 Krakatoa volcano eruption, he has this big section on this, and it's really cool, so I want to read through this. Tim writes, I'm overwhelmed by the amount of things I need to tell you about the Krakatoa volcano eruption. And so he has a bullet points. Krakatoa is an island in Indonesia, and the eruption happened on August 27th, 1883. The eruption completely annihilated the island, sending an enormous amount of debris 17 miles into the sky at half a mile per second. It also caused one of the most deadly and far-reaching tsunamis in history. In total, the Krakatoa volcano eruption killed 36,000 people. But the most amazing thing about the eruption was its sound. It made arguably the loudest sound on Earth in modern history. It was so loud that the shockwave extended far enough to rupture the eardrums of sailors 40 miles away. Again, it ruptured the eardrums of sailors 40 miles away. 100 miles away, the sound was still 172 decibels, enough to permanently destroy someone's ears or even kill them. And Tim writes, "Wherever you are, think of a place that's about 100 miles away. Now imagine something happening there that causes a sound so loud where you are that if you were screaming at the top of your lungs directly into someone's ear when the sound hit, they wouldn't be able to hear that you were doing it." So for comparison, the Saturn V launch sound was at 170 decibels, 100 meters away. Krakatoa was higher than that, 100 miles away. And then he talks about some things that happened even further away. The sound cracked a foot-thick concrete wall 300 miles away. The sound was heard all the way in Australia, where it sounded like a distant cannonball being fired, and even as far away as Rodriguez Island, 3,000 miles away. And then Tim goes into italics. 3,000 miles away. "I'm currently in New York. Imagine if something happened in California or in Europe that I could hear in New York. I can't even." After the sound eventually got far enough away that humans couldn't hear it anymore, barometers all over the world were going nuts for the next few days as the sound wave circled the Earth 3.5 times. And then finally, you know the famous painting, The Scream? Well, you know how the sky is all red for some reason? The sky is red because the painter, Edvard Munch, was inspired to paint it after seeing the Krakatoa caused red skies all over the Western Hemisphere in the year after the eruption. And then he just finishes the section by saying, "It was a big eruption." And then the next section, he lists the other way that sounds can get louder or go beyond 194 decibels on Earth. And that other way is other mediums. So there can be louder sound than 194 decibels, but not on the Earth's surface. There can be louder sounds in the ocean, in the land, or on other planets. The gas giants in our solar system, for example, have denser atmospheres than Earth, which allow for higher pressure wave amplitudes, and with incredibly fast winds and powerful storms, there's plenty of opportunity there to make loud things. And then he writes, "What isn't loud is almost everything in space." Almost everything else in space. You've probably heard the term, sound doesn't travel in a vacuum, but it makes sense now, right? Sound is pressure waves through matter. If there's no matter, there's no sound. There can be immense heat and radiation and force, but to a nearby observing human, it's all dead silent. On the other hand, if hypothetically there were air filling the universe, then suddenly things would get very loud. Forget the terrifying concept of the sound of a supernova. Just the dumb sun sitting there hanging out would ring in at an astounding 290 decibels. According to one solar physicist, we'd hear that on Earth as a 100 decibel sound, the volume of a motorcycle, all the time, every day, everywhere. And he writes, "Be happy that sound doesn't travel in a vacuum." And then at the end of the article, he writes something more philosophical. He just says, "One last thought. Researching for this post and learning about what sound is gave me a new perspective on the tree falling in the forest with nobody there to hear it question." So for people who haven't heard this, it's just this an old philosophical question that you can ask where if you imagine that a tree has fallen in the forest, but there's nobody around to hear it. And the question is, does it still make a sound? And if you say no or yes or whatever your answer is, one of the follow-up questions you can ask somebody is, how do you know? Now presumably this question came around before there were security cameras in existence, but regardless, Tim has a take on this question. He says, I now think that no, the tree doesn't make a sound. It makes an air pressure wave, and that's it. The concept of sound is by definition a biological being's perception of the pressure wave. And if there are no ears around to perceive the pressure wave, there is no sound. He says, it's a little like asking, if humans go extinct, and somewhere in the post-apocalyptic rubble, there's a photo of a beautiful woman lying there, is she still beautiful? And he says, I kind of don't think she is, because the only thing that's beautiful about her is that humans found her beautiful, and without humans, she's no more beautiful than the female beetle a few feet away, rummaging around the rubble, right? And that's the end of the article. And it's also the end of this podcast. So thank you very much for listening to this episode. If you'd like to listen to other episodes, which presumably there will be, this is the first episode, but I hope to do more of these, go to my website at bentibbetts.net. That's BENTIBBETTS.net. And once again, I would really appreciate your feedback on this, if you have any. I fully expect this show to evolve as I learn what's useful for other people to hear and what's interesting for me to talk about and how I should structure this. I also would appreciate feedback if I got any of the science wrong on the physics of sound today. I don't have any background in science. I'm just an interested person, and I'm a musician, and I would love to know if anything I said was really terribly wrong. And of course, all this stuff came from Tim Urban's article, so maybe you should take it up with him. I should forward my hate mail to Tim. But regardless, thank you for listening, and I hope that you have a good rest of your day. Until next time.